Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, the number of migrant apprehensions at the southern border has dropped dramatically in recent months.
And what is the ultimate potential of AI in healthcare? And what are some potential issues with that?
But first, President Biden's announcement yesterday that he would end his reelection campaign has led to a number of Democratic officials coalescing around Vice President Kamala Harris to be the party's presidential nominee. It's also led to a lot of conversation about the possibility of Arizona Senator Mark Kelly being a potential candidate to be the Democrats' new vice presidential nominee. With me to talk about this, as well as what new campaign finance numbers say about the state of a few key races, is KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez from the Politics Desk. Good morning, Cameron.
Good morning.
So let's start with what Democrats in Arizona are saying about President Biden deciding to step down from the race and presumably, and his endorsement anyway, of Vice President Kamala Harris.
Well, from the Democrats, I've heard that he's doing a great thing, that this is the responsible step, and he's been such a great leader, and this is such a great idea for him to do this and, you know, pave the way for someone who can succeed. I've not heard that from Republicans, though. And then when it comes to Kelly, that is sort of a popular rumor that's been swirling around, not just for the past few days, but really for a few weeks now. And I think that he would be a popular choice among Democrats in Arizona. But the question is, would he be popular nationwide?
Right. I mean, there was some polling a week or two ago that looked at a few non-Biden Democrats in various states, and he was one of them, that showed that he was basically outpolling President Biden in terms of if they were to be at the top of the ticket. Obviously, there's a number of candidates who could be the running mates for Vice President Harris if she is, in fact, the nominee. Kelly being from a swing state, though, that potentially helps, right?
Sure. But it's also risky to give up that Senate seat and make him go somewhere else. And then Hobbs, I believe, would have to appoint someone to fill that Senate seat. And those are sort of hard fought in a swing state. Plus,
right.
You know, Kelly doesn't have maybe that much national name recognition. In Arizona, he's pretty well known and pretty popular, and maybe it would help get Arizona on board. But in other states, would people support that? Not clear.
So I know you also had a chance to speak with some high-ranking Republicans over the weekend after President Biden made his announcement. What did they have to say?
They didn't say they think he's a great leader. They said he should have stepped down, but they think that he should have done it sooner. And they think that if he is not, quote, competent, then he should resign altogether from being the president of the United States in the meantime. And they said that they feel bad for the Democrat voters who have been betrayed by their leadership and don't have options.
Safe to say they still think that President Trump, former President Trump, will win come November?
Oh, yes, definitely. They all said, all of the Republicans I spoke to said across the board that they think that Trump's going to win Arizona, whether it's Biden or Harris at the top of the ticket.
So I know you also went out yesterday and talked to just some regular voters at Tempe Marketplace. What kinds of things did you hear from them?
It was fun to do that. And I spoke to mostly Democrats because it was Tempe, but also one Republican. And they all either were surprised, but I mean, if they were finding out from the first time for me, they were like, oh, well, that's crazy. But also it makes sense. Everyone sort of said they thought it was a good idea. The Democrat voters I talked to said they're more excited to vote for Harris than they would have been to vote for Biden. Mm-hmm. And one person actually said he wasn't thinking of voting at all. But now he will, and he will come out and vote for Harris.
Were there actually people who heard about this for the first time from you?
Yes, just shouting at them on the street, politely.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is interesting. All right, so let's talk about some campaign finance numbers, because there are obviously other races on the ballot, specifically the U.S. Senate race, where Carrie Lake is facing a primary on the Republican side, but she is widely expected to be the nominee.
Yes.
And Congressman Ruben Gallego will be the Democratic nominee. There's a lot of money in this race, but right now anyway, it seems not to be super competitive in the money, on the money side, not the polling side, on the money side.
On the money side, in this most recent quarter, which all the campaign finance information just came out about, Gallego pulled in a lot of money, I believe more than $14 million added to an already quite large stash, and he's left with, I believe, nine point something cash on hand, 9 point something million cash on hand. So he's been spending quite a lot of money on this race. Even for a Senate race, that's pretty impressive. And Lake's not doing poorly, but she is not coming close to that.
Is it a matter of her not raising as much or her spending more or more quickly?
Well, I don't. First of all, it's not over yet.
Of course.
I mean, we're a few weeks out from the primary election, but of course, she does have more time before the general election. And she doesn't really have a competitive primary in a lot of people's eyes. She is widely thought to be the Republican candidate. She's expected to get that, you know, vote. But she does have time to fundraise more. And she is maybe not spending as much as she could be yet, but that could change.
And is it safe to say that there will be a lot of outside money coming into this race as well? That, like, the amount of the candidates raise is important, but maybe not all important.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just sort of a snapshot. Campaign finance has a lot of elements to it. And for a U.S. Senate race, there's a lot of outside money from PACs, for example, that goes into it.
Have you heard anything from sort of pundits or observers about what they make of where this race is financially at the moment?
Financially, it's a good sign for the Democrats. Democrats have been doing well in terms of getting national money in the last few elections. I even looked at that for legislative races for the state Senate and state House. And yeah, Democrats have been doing very well at that. It's a good sign, but it's not a sure thing. You can't necessarily buy your way into the state Senate. It's just a feather in the cap.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. That is KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez from the Politics Desk. Thanks, Cameron.
Thank you.
As we just heard, the political world is in uncharted territory this morning after President Joe Biden announced yesterday he is pulling out of the 2024 race. Now all eyes are on his VP, Kamala Harris. But there's also the question of who would be her running mate, and that's where Arizonans might sit up and listen. Arizona Senator Mark Kelly is on the VP watch list, and the Arizona Republic's editorial page editor Elvia Diaz wasted no time getting behind him. She joins us now, as she does every Monday morning, to talk more about it. Good morning, Elvia.
Good morning.
Okay, so you wrote an op-ed within just a couple of hours of President Biden's monumental announcement yesterday, outlining why you think Mark Kelly would be a perfect VP pick for a Kamala Harris ticket. That is, if she ends up being the nominee, which it looks like she may be at this point, at least. Tell us why.
Well, I mean, Mark Kelly has been, as you mentioned there in the intro, on the watch list. And actually, you know, the New York Times and other newspapers have him as a potential presidential contender. I don't see that. So that's why I immediately thought about VP, and especially, you know, right after all the pouring of support for Kamala Harris. So it's unlikely that some credible person is going to challenge her. So I think the question now is who's going to be her VP. Mm-hmm. And Mark Kelly, you know, Mark Kelly has been on that watch list. So it's not out of thin air. You know, people have been talking about it for weeks. And, you know, I'm pretty sure they're already vetting him. Because there's not a lot of time to select a vice president, right? I mean, Kamala Harris doesn't have the luxury anymore, so she will have to make a decision fairly quick.
Yeah. And Mark Kelly released a statement, you know, immediately not just praising Joe Biden and his record, but endorsing Harris, which is not something we saw from all Democrats yesterday.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, and it's very telling that he immediately threw his support. And you are correct. I mean, at the top of mind, it was former President Barack Obama and the former Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, who I don't believe they still haven't endorsed Kamala Harris. So very telling for Kelly to do it. I was actually expecting him to do it sooner. I think he waited a little longer, and that's why I was making phone calls, you know, and talking to people, like waiting what Kelly's going to say. But then we saw the announcement. Mm-hmm. And you know what? He does have a compelling story, and he is credible. Again, it's not out of thin air. I mean, the vice president, from my point of view, has to pick a VP from some of the most competitive states, the ones that are going to make or break her campaign. And, you know, those are, you know, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Arizona. Yeah. So, and Mark Kelly checks all those boxes that she needs.
Yeah. So, yeah, that there's a measure of electability here, right? The politics side of this. You call Kelly a serious senator. He is a moderate. We're looking at sort of suburban women voters, independents, voters of color, you know, groups that a Democratic nominee would really have to win.
Yeah, and those are exactly the votes that Harris is going to be looking for, you know, in Kelly. You know, when I say and when others say that he is serious, I mean, he's an astronaut, for goodness sake. I mean, who doesn't love an astronaut, right, to begin with? What a compelling story, right? He's right. A tough guy, and he's been moderate. He's been, you know, no drama. He's been very focused on policy. He's polite. He's smart, really smart. And he's young. I mean, he's only 60. And then, you know, he has his personal story. He's married to the former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, who we all know, you know, was shot in the head. And since then, he picked up the mantle of gun control. So he has all those attributes. And, you know, I do believe he has the crossover appeal that you mentioned, you know, from minorities to white women to rural voters. So we'll see. I do think he's being considered very seriously.
Yeah. Let me ask you about his wife, about former Congresswoman from Tucson, Gabby Giffords. I mean, she was the first politician in that family. Her story is so cemented in sort of American history at this point. How does that play into this, you think?
Well, I mean, that humanizes everything, right? I mean, she survived the shooting, but, you know, many others did not. And that is incredibly unfortunate. I mean, the country knows her name and by default, you know, knows Mark Kelly's name as a result of that. I mean, he has been by her side ever since, you know, so a love story, I would call it. So, I mean, any ordinary Arizonan in ordinary American would identify with something like that. So of course that would play huge into any campaign. And, you know, if he is picked and if he accepts, I'm pretty sure she's going to play a significant role.
Mm. Let me ask you lastly here, Elvia, to just back up and talk about just how unprecedented this all is, right? This moment is, even this conversation we're having, right? Like, Democrats, even the country, like, have never been in this position before where a president, an incumbent, has dropped out of a race so late in the game and everything's kind of up in the air. I wonder, as someone on the left, like, do you see this as an opportunity for the Democratic Party heading into a very consequential election? Or are you kind of worried about the upheaval of all of this?
No, at this point, it's a huge opportunity for Democrats to redefine themselves. I mean, up until 2 days ago, it seemed pretty uncertain, pretty chaotic. I mean, Democrats haven't had an open convention since 1968, and that did not go well. So a lot of people, a lot of Democrats, a lot of independents were incredibly nervous. And then, you know, especially coming out of the assassination attempt of President Donald Trump. He just finished his convention. And I mean, it seemed that the campaign was over, at least from their point of view, right? So no, this is a huge opportunity. And just seeing how the party and Democrats had coalesced behind Harris is very telling that they want to unify. They do see as an opportunity to win, and it gives a chance to throw the Trump campaign off balance, right? So right now, they don't know whom they're running against. I mean, they have prepared everything to run against Joe Biden, and, you know, they wanted him to stay, and now that's not going to be the case. And even this morning, the possible contenders that could have, you know, challenged Harris at the convention are already supporting her. So yeah, they are unifying, and I that's why I think the VP's selection is going to be incredibly important, especially if it is someone that can bring other voters who are, you know, kind of second guessing the VP.
Yeah. All right. We will leave it there for now. So much to watch for. That is the Arizona Republic's editorial page editor, Elvia Diaz, who joins us on Monday mornings. Elvia, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how and when we should talk about mental health. But first, California health officials will start using AI to translate certain websites and documents into a variety of languages. An official with that state's Health and Human Services Agency says human editors will oversee and edit the translations. This is just one area in which artificial intelligence is being used in healthcare, and my next guest believes AI will only become more widely used in that field going forward. James Hodge is a professor at ASU's Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law and director of the Center for Public Health Law and Policy. He joins me. And James, what do you think, first off, of this plan in California?
Hey, listen, this is exactly what might be considered one of the most innocuous uses of AI as we go forward. The opportunity to provide real information to consumers in healthcare and other arenas through translatable information is a success story for AI if it can do it accurately, Mark. And if it can't do it accurately, now we've got some problems.
Well, that's the real question, right? And how do we know? How do we try to keep tabs on that?
Well, we could use humans to actually overview and assess, was that translation into this foreign language accurate based on what we're predicting for this particular site? That's possible, of course. But that's time consuming. I expect AI will be checking its own devices and own output through different interventions to make sure the accuracy is as good as we can get it.
Does that give you pause if AI is checking up on AI?
Wouldn't it for you?
A little bit, yeah.
If you're talking about medical information, the type of which consumers may rely upon, especially which they're going to a site and hearing it in a language that sounds familiar to them, if it makes mistakes, we better hope something's checking on it. But that check itself could be as flawed as the original information.
So what would you like to see in terms of how this might be rolled out? Like, what would make you confident that this could be as innocuous and maybe as helpful as some people think it is? What would be the way to roll it out in your mind?
Well, I think a gold standard would be, of course, we can actually utilize AI fully to make the translations, work within that specific environment, and vet those cleanly with humans involved, particularly medically trained persons who can validate the data is actually an accurate and fair assessment of what persons in that culture or ethnicity would be listening to and understanding from the language as translated. But we're not going to get that gold standard, I don't believe, on all of these translations. That's time consuming, and frankly, AI is designed to expedite that. I think AI is going to be checking up on the accuracy across different programs. That's what we're going to watch for very closely.
Are there other forums in which AI is being used in healthcare? I can't imagine that there aren't.
It's almost a question mark at this point. Where is it not being used in healthcare delivery? Let me give you some common examples so we're all very familiar with where this is now and where it's going. So in regards to artificial intelligence and its implications and repercussions for healthcare delivery, it is currently being used in the health insurance industry to determine who's going to get vetted for what specific care. Doctors are using it to sort of assess patients' records and information. Are they providing the most accurate care? It's being used in prescription industries, websites that would actually take in information and provide prescriptions based on what you provide to that specific site. It's a question not so much of what other applications, but what application is it not being used? And that's the beginning. It will only continue to proliferate extensively over decades to come, so much so that one day I'm predicting your main healthcare delivery may be through AI and you'll see a doctor only when absolutely necessary.
Hmm. What are you seeing in terms of how effective AI is in some of those things?
Well, let's talk about one example in regards to radiologic assessments, for example. Its accuracy there can be outstanding. And it is far more efficient than humans might be on those specific fronts.
Like looking at x-rays and things like
that. Yeah, exactly. Or other types of data we may get through electronic transmissions about human tissue or otherwise. It can be really accurate, really capable of providing some of the better insights as to what the current status is for detecting everything from tumors to specific tears or other things within muscular structure. Now, with all that said, even though it's got its great applications there that are huge improvements over what humans can do, the risks of what and how far AI could go in these arenas, particularly where you see it used as a gatekeeping program, the type of program that you're seeing already, big insurers like Humana being sued over because their gatekeeping functions are what's telling Medicare patients right now in some cases, you get access to this care or you don't, based on AI, not a doctor making that assessment or what we'll call the utilization reviewer, but an actual program. That's happening right now as we speak.
So in terms of like looking at x-rays or maybe, you know, reviewing MRIs or other like lab results, yeah, things like that, is that the kind of thing – like would you consider that maybe as innocuous as maybe doing the translating that, that California is doing?
Quite possibly even more so. I mean, it's a program that can be honed in to look very closely at specific imagery and determine, are we seeing cancer cells here or are we not? To that degree, that can be as innocuous as you can ask for. There's not a lot of privacy repercussions. There are potential for adverse events or mistakes to be made, but humans have been making those same mistakes for decades, of course. So with that said, technology properly, you know, garnered, properly used, could be very effective and cost efficient. No one in the healthcare industry will stop short of that, Mark. AI is not going to stop with these specific really helpful applications. Everybody in the industry is already trying to think through exactly how to use it even more extensively for potentially improving care for us as Americans, but honestly as well for making it less expensive at certain profit levels.
Right. Well, so what are the next steps or potential next steps then between where we are now and where we could be in terms of what you suggested? AI is your main doctor.
Next steps are going to be profound. We've seen Congress. We've seen the president literally all last summer make, you know, significant strides at how far they were going to go to regulate AI. But, you know, things have cooled on that.
In those areas in which AI is being used now, to what extent do patients know that AI is being used? Like if I go for an x-ray, do I know that a radiologist is not looking at my scan, or do I know that it's AI?
You would be hard-pressed to know it in so many capacities. Now, let's be clear. I don't think this is because doctors are hiding the ball on us and literally saying, we're not going to tell you how or why we're using AI to provide better care for you. But there's no disclosure requirements for that. If the technology can be utilized more effectively to provide better care, doctors have been doing that for decades. Mm-hmm. They will continue to do that. So will radiologists and everyone along the way. But a really neat example of this is one I was discussing recently with my center colleague, Jen Pyatt, where we were talking about these prescription applications where you can go and put in some rare information about yourself, minimal stuff, but that you might get approved for a prescription. Do you know whether a doctor actually saw that information or whether some AI program decided you get access versus you don't? Honestly, at this juncture, most Americans will have no clue to that. And until further reporting requires it, you may not have that disclosed even.
So you mentioned the idea that this could potentially make healthcare less expensive. What is the potential there, and are there potential problems with how that might work?
Yeah, Mark, come on. We're talking about a $3.5 trillion per annum industry in the United States. It is the biggest component of our entire budget in the United States, but for military. And to that end, when there's billions of dollars at stake here, we're going to see it utilized as fully as possible. I really foresee that ahead. So the projection for AI is that it will be in healthcare, I think, as thoroughly used as any other industry in the United States for any other specific purpose. Hmm. I would project that because we're already seeing that. The repercussions, they're out there already. These models are only as good or as well as they can perform based on what they're trained on. The data that we've consistently seen can be biased, can be discriminatory, can lead to actual outcomes for patients that are based on truly wrong misinformation, leading to, you know, poor outcomes for those patients. But let's not knock it completely now here. Properly trained, properly advised, utilized effectively, checked for adverse related events, and marked with hopeful benefit of patients actually being able to report on what they see as abuses or problems within the industry itself, we've got a chance to utilize this technology very effectively down the road.
All right. That is James Hodge, director of the ASU Center for Public Health Law and Policy at the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law. James, great as always to talk to you. Thank you.
A real pleasure, Mark. Thank you.
As the the Trump team figures out how to reshape their campaign against a new candidate, one thing will likely remain the same: their razor focus on the border and President Biden's record on it. The number of migrants arriving at the southern border has skyrocketed under the Biden administration for a lot of reasons. But this is a trend that has changed pretty dramatically in the last few months. Last month, the number of migrants entering Arizona was the lowest it's been in more than 3 years. It comes after the president's move to limit asylum at the border earlier this summer. And here to tell us more is Danielle Camara with Arizona Public Media in Tucson. Good morning, Danielle.
Good morning. Great to be with you.
Thanks for coming on. So tell us first what these numbers look like. Like, how big is this drop?
Yeah, so basically in Arizona's Tucson sector, Border Patrol apprehended 22,400 migrants in June, which is about two-thirds the number of people that they apprehended in May, which is at its lowest point since February of 2021. And that is, we're seeing similar numbers across the entire Southwest border. Border Patrol encounters at the southern border between ports of entry were 29% lower in June than May, if you look at the entire Southwest border.
Right. So remind us what the president's executive order did that so drastically changed things at the border.
Yeah. So basically, the executive order allowed for a change in the way that migrants are seeking asylum or are asking to be entered into immigration court to get a day in court to ask a judge for asylum. Mm-hmm. When there is a 7-day average that sees numbers of people above 2,500 people, the administration is essentially sending people either directly back to Mexico or sending them back to the country of origin, which they came from, until that daily number for a 7-day average has fallen below 1,500, which it has not yet, as far as the latest data that we're seeing. So not only are people finding it much harder to ask for asylum when they do cross unauthorized between a port of entry, there are also enhanced consequences. So most of those people are getting a minimum of a 5-year ban before they are allowed to ask for asylum or come back into the country through any other means.
Right. So how impactful has this been? Like, how many migrants seeking asylum have been turned away?
Yeah, so it's been quite impactful. The administration has returned thousands of people since this went into effect. And just as an example of what I've been seeing on the ground, I was in Nogales, Sonora a couple weeks ago. And at that point, there was about 200 people a day that had crossed the border that had been quickly processed by Border Patrol and border officials and were just returned back to the port of entry on the southern side of the border. And a lot of the shelters at that time were seeing a huge increase in people who had been returned, much higher numbers than they were seeing before this rule went into effect.
So on the southern side of the border, that's interesting. That's what we're seeing on the ground. Migrant aid groups and advocates have been highly critical of this decision. Is there any precedent for this? What could the results be?
Yeah, so that's accurate that groups that help migrants actually have taken this rule to court. And so we will see what happens with that in the near future. One of the fears that people have, aside from the fact that they say that migrants are not being allowed to ask for an asylum claim, which is protected under international treaties as well as domestic law. Mm-hmm. But another thing they're worried about is that people will put themselves in even more dangerous situations to try and evade Border Patrol in order to get into the country without being detected, which potentially could lead people into situations where they are more likely to get lost in the desert and even more likely to die. So that's one of the fears.
Right. Watching those numbers of people dying in the desert. You're also reporting, Danielle, that the type of migrants crossing the border has changed since May. Tell us how.
Yeah. So basically, I mean, the type of migrant crossing the border has been changing for a couple of years now, and it's just becoming more and more apparent. One of the biggest changes is that a lot more families are coming. And again, that has been a trend for a while, but in recent months, it's been even more Mexican families. So families fleeing the southern states and Mexico, for the most part, due to increased levels of violence and increased levels of organized crime. I go down to the border mm-hmm. and talk to migrants at shelters on a regular basis. And many of them have similar stories that they felt like their lives were in jeopardy. They were being threatened. Their children were not safe. So a lot more families and a lot more families from Mexico.
Okay. We'll leave it there for now. That is Danielle Camara joining us from Tucson with Arizona Public Media there joining us. Danielle, appreciate you coming on. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Taiwan this week will be carrying out military exercises in an effort to test its readiness for a potential invasion from China. With me via Skype for our weekly look at some of the key global stories in the coming days is the BBC's Jonathan Frewin in London. And Jonathan, what are these exercises all about?
Well, these are annual war games known as Han Kuang, and Taiwan's military essentially will be testing how it might respond to any aggressive action from China, which of course considers self-governing Taiwan to be part of itself. The annual exercises have been going on for more than 40 years, and they typically feature large-scale live-fire demonstrations with the president and top military officials watching over the events. When Taiwan's President William Lai took office back in May, China conducted 2 days of war games around Taiwan itself. And one of the exercises that Taiwan's military will be practicing is reportedly responding to a hot war that might emerge in the midst of China carrying out what appeared at first to be simply military exercises. Taiwan's Defense Minister Wellington Koo has announced a number of changes to the normal routine for this year's event. And that includes that the military are going to be conducting some live fire exercises at night to test the armed forces' 24-hour defense capabilities. Of course, the Taiwanese military is much smaller than that of China, and Taiwan has been watching closely the situation in Ukraine, whose military is also much smaller than Russia's, to see what lessons it can learn and integrate into its own exercises.
And this, of course, comes at a somewhat challenging time for Taiwan, given the possibility of former President Donald Trump being reelected here. And he's been kind of lukewarm about possible support for Taiwan in the past.
Yeah, that's right. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump said in an interview with Bloomberg recently that Taiwan should pay the U.S. for defense. He likened the U.S. to an insurance company for the island. Taiwan's premier, Chou Jung-tai, responded to Donald Trump's remarks by saying Taiwan is, quote, willing to take on more responsibility and would defend itself. President Joe Biden has previously said that he would send troops in to defend Taiwan if needed. Last month, the Biden administration approved a $360 million weapons sale to Taiwan, sending the island hundreds of armed drones, missile equipment and related support material. Now, it's worth noting, of course, that Taiwan pays for the military equipment, and not everyone in the Republican Party agrees with former President Trump. House Representative Michael McCaul is chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, and he described Taiwan as a perfect example of what the U.S. wants its allies to do, pointing out, quote, they have consistently been one of the biggest buyers of U.S. weapons for its defense. And he had actually traveled to Taiwan last month to reaffirm U.S. support for the island, though obviously he's not the person who would be the top decision maker should Donald Trump be reelected.
Right. All right, Jonathan, let's go now to Venezuela, where on Sunday voters in that country go to the polls. What should we be looking out for there?
Well, Nicolas Maduro has been president of Venezuela since 2013 and is running for re-election. The opposition leader is Maria Corina Machado, and she won the primary to be the opposition candidate to Nicolas Maduro last October. But she was prevented from running for president by Venezuela's top court back in January amid allegations of fraud and tax violations, as well as the accusation that she was seeking economic sanctions that the U.S. imposed on Venezuela over the last decade. Now, those are allegations that she described as judicial criminality at the time. So the opposition sought a different candidate and settled on a former diplomat named Edmundo Gonzalez. That came about almost by chance, though, because they tried to submit Karina Yoris, an octogenarian academic, as their candidate, but they'd been unable to log into the registration system to get her on the ballot. Instead, one of the parties forming the opposition coalition managed to get an extension to the deadline and submitted Edmundo Gonzalez's name. Now, he's aged 74 and is a former diplomat. The Venezuelan government has suggested that he's simply a puppet of the disqualified presidential candidate, Maria Corina Machado. But Mr. Gonzalez's popularity has risen since becoming the candidate. He now has a 20-point polling lead over Nicolas Maduro, although the opposition is concerned that the election result may be tampered with. The 2018 election, in which Nicolas Maduro was re-elected to a second term, was widely dismissed as being neither free nor fair, though the opposition coalition led by Ms. Machado is urging its supporters to turn out to vote despite these concerns, arguing that overwhelming support for their unity candidate would make it harder for any fraud to take place.
And Jonathan, am I right that there has also been a string of arrests of opposition activists and staffers in the run-up to the election?
Well, yeah, that's right. And arguably the most high profile of these so far came last week when Maria Corina Machado's security chief, Machado's Avila, was detained on Wednesday. Ms. Machado wrote on social media that Mr. Avila had been accused of gender violence, adding that his arrest was connected to an incident the Saturday before in which a number of women had tried to attack her and the opposition presidential candidate, Edmundo Gonzalez. She alleges that the incident was witnessed by dozens of people and that footage showed it had been a deliberate provocation designed to leave her without protection just a week or so before the presidential election. Now, Miltiades Avila was freed the next day, but dozens of members of Maria Corina Machado's campaign team have been arrested in recent weeks, with some accused of involvement in anti-government conspiracies. Restaurant and food stall owners have also complained about their businesses being closed down by officials after they served the opposition leaders. For its part, the government alleges that the businesses were shuttered because their paperwork was not in order. So there's a pretty febrile atmosphere ahead of the election, scheduled to take place this Sunday.
Yeah, that is interesting. All right, Jonathan, finally, let's go to Paris, where the Summer Olympics are set to kick off pretty soon. Opening ceremony set for Friday, right?
Yeah, that's right. And in a break with tradition, the opening ceremony is happening outside the Olympic Stadium, with dozens of boats scheduled to carry thousands of athletes and performers on a route lasting several miles down the River Seine. The parade will sail past the Notre Dame Cathedral and arrive near the Eiffel Tower after passing under a number of bridges and past an array of other significant landmarks. More than 300,000 spectators are expected to watch from the river's banks, with more than 100 heads of state and government in attendance. Now, of course, such an event presents a significant security challenge, so there will be tens of thousands of police on hand to keep the event safe. There is actually some sporting action due to take place from this Wednesday, when pool matches begin in football, rugby sevens, handball and archery. Overall, there are 329 gold medal events at the Games, with a whopping 39 being won on the penultimate day of competition, which is the 10th of August, a Saturday. The first medals, though, will be awarded this coming Saturday, and that will be for shooting mixed team air rifle. Now, it's a century since Paris last hosted the Olympics back in 1924. British runners Eric Liddell and Harold Abrahams won gold medals, later immortalised by the film Chariots of Fire. The Games were also held in Paris in 1900, but because that event took place at the same time as the Paris World Fair, our correspondent in Paris says many competitors weren't even aware they were taking part in the Olympics.
Oh, jeez.
Now, yeah, crazy. There were some strange events in those games as well, such as artillery firing and hot air ballooning.
Wow. All right. That is the BBC's Jonathan Frewin in London. Jonathan, thanks as always. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Mark.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. There is a mental health crisis among young people today. The U.S. Surgeon General has issued advisories. There was a national state of emergency in child and adolescent health issued in 2021. Large percentages of teens report feeling sadness and hopelessness. Drug overdoses have spiked, and suicides are the second leading cause of death for this group. At the same time, mental health has become something everyone talks about in childhood and young adulthood. Kids talk about it in group chats and online. Schools have made preventative measures like teaching emotional awareness and mindfulness part of their missions. But now, as the New York Times has reported, some researchers are asking a relatively controversial question. Are we talking about mental health too much? Some studies have shown limited or even negative results from school-based mental health interventions, and some are concerned that all of this talk is leading kids to label themselves as someone who has anxiety or depression when they might just be experiencing the normal kinds of bumps and bruises being a teen. I spoke more about it all with Matt Moix, past president of the Arizona Association of School Psychologists and coordinator of psychological services for Gilbert Public Schools. He's been working in school psychology in Arizona for 25 years, from elementary all the way up to high school. And he told me there's a balance here we need to meet.
It's actually really interesting, and it's not just mental health. What people think of in terms of mental health, they're probably thinking of our high school students that are experiencing tons of anxiety and depression. But it shows up much earlier than that with our elementary school students who show up either not ready for school or some sort of traumatic experience prior to showing up for school, and they exhibit a lot of significant behavioral challenges as well as emotional difficulties. So at the elementary level, it looks like acting out and school refusal and noncompliance and aggression. And so it could be really intense and scary, for lack of a better word. And I think that's really taxing for teachers as well as mental health professionals in the schools. When you get into junior high and high school, it looks a little different, a lot less externalizing behavior, we call it. They're not necessarily throwing desks and chairs, but they are breaking down in class, or they're refusing to come to school, or they're asking to come to the counseling office or to see the school psychologist or the school social worker, depending on who's available, because the thought of being in school or in the classroom is just overwhelming for them at that moment.
Hmm. So it's gotten worse. It's gotten harder.
Oh, absolutely. Over the last, 2.5 decades, we've definitely seen an increase. I know everybody talks about COVID and we're all sick of talking about the impact of COVID. But since COVID, since we returned to school, it's been exponentially worse. We were seeing increases in all of these things prior to COVID. But I think COVID just exacerbated that for everyone. And why that is, whether it was the social isolation, whether it just threw us into the lack of providers, whatever the case may be, we've just seen a sharp increase since we've returned several years ago.
What about suicide, sort of the worst case scenario here?
We definitely have seen an increase in reports of suicidal ideation, whether they're talking about having thoughts of killing themselves or whether they're making plans. We've seen definitely increases in attempts, unfortunately, and completed suicides, unfortunately, are also on the rise. 1 in 15 high school students nationwide will attempt suicide. So it's really kind of the worst case scenario, as you said. It's an increase in all those things that are happening.
Yeah. Okay, so tell us what programming looks like in the Gilbert School District and in schools that you work in when it comes to mental health. There's a lot of mindfulness training in schools now, a lot of sort of training about identifying feelings and emotions and coping and things like that. What do you do?
So in Gilbert, we're very lucky in that we have school social workers, school mental health counselors, as well as school psychologists who serve as members of our behavioral health teams on every campus, along with the school nurse and the school administrator. Part of the behavioral health team's role isn't to do SEL curriculum or go into classrooms and do those lessons.
That's social emotional learning.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Yes, social emotional learning. Social workers will do that as part of that. We try to integrate. Best practice would be, no matter where you are, that's kind of just part of your daily experience. And it's kind of a buzzword. It has some negative connotations, social emotional learning does, in that in some communities it's seen as we're trying to brainwash students. And really it's just how to get along, how to solve problems, how to deal with difficult things is really what we try to focus on. Students that express some concerns, or we start to have concerns about how they're functioning, their behavior concerns, their social emotional concerns, that's when the behavioral health team might design interventions, obviously in conjunction with the parent, and talk with them about whether we provide group counseling support or individual counseling support with the social work services or with the school psychologist or the school counselor. We might work with the family to identify outside resources that they might be able to access to help their student make progress.
Mm-hmm.
And then obviously the highest level is when we've got some pretty significant needs and we need to be working with that family to identify all of those outside resources, as well as the things we're doing in school in terms of putting plans in place and doing risk assessments and threat assessments and those kinds of things.
Yeah. So let me pose something to you that is a little counterintuitive here. There are some researchers who are now kind of questioning the mass of mental health prevention training that we've seen in schools. A little different maybe than what you're talking about, but
for sure,
a lot of this kind of language, right? And it's not a political thing. Like, this is research showing that we might be like overdoing it, for lack of a better phrase, that mental health awareness campaigns will help some young people who have serious problems and need help, but that for others it seems to lead them to sort of overinterpret relatively mild symptoms or like self-label themselves when they're really not as bad off as they might think. What do you make of that?
So it's definitely interesting research, and I think what I've seen has every bit of research I've read about it has indicated we need to do further research and try to identify exactly what's going on. But I think anyone who's worked in schools or any parent who's got a teenage child has dealt with this at one time or another, where let's say your adolescent comes home and says, my friend has depression and I think I might have it too. I'm using the word contagion. That's not the good word for it, but that's kind of what it is. That it seems like they want to over-label everything, and everything they encounter needs a label, and we've got to somehow identify that symptom as a problem that needs treatment as opposed to something that maybe we just need to work through. We all experience things in our lives that are challenging, that give us a little bit of anxiety. Doesn't mean we have an anxiety disorder. Sometimes we get sad and we need to find a way to not be sad or to work through that, but it doesn't mean we have depression. And I think one of the concerns of that research that might have some validity is that if we talk too much about it, it does lead to that symptom identification and overdiagnosis.
Do you think social media plays into that?
I think social media does two things. It does a lot of things, but two things that it does is, one, it does lead into that the influencers talk about depression and anxiety, and students identify with that and they start to label themselves as having that. But I think students also, social media, when you're invested in it and you're spending so much time looking at social media and interacting on social media, it inhibits your ability to have real, meaningful relationships and decreases your ability to develop coping skills and resiliency that is what you need to be able to get through those times when you're facing something that's anxiety provoking or something that makes you sad.
Yeah. It's touchy, right? Like, because we don't want to forget that, and many in the mental health world will say this, like the broad consensus is that the bigger problem is a lack of mental health treatment available for kids who really need it.
Absolutely.
Do you see that side of it too?
Absolutely. 75% to 80% of students that need mental health supports and mental health treatments aren't able to access it. Mm-hmm. And the vast majority of students, their first line of defense is a school. That's where they're able to get some sort of, not necessarily treatment, but access to a mental health provider who could provide support and guidance. And the fear with citing that research about us over-identifying is that if we shut it all off, then the kids who really do need it, they aren't going to be able to access it. So
right.
I think that's the bigger issue, is I think the solution would be to not spend all of your time and your social emotional lessons identifying feelings and identifying disorders. It would be more about teaching coping skills and resiliency and things like that.
We'll leave it there for now. Matt Moix, past president of the Arizona Association of School Psychologists, coordinator of psychological services for the Gilbert Public Schools. Matt, thank you for coming in. Thank you for taking the time to talk this through. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And that'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. Don't forget, you can follow us on Instagram. All the cool kids are doing it. We are at KJZZ The Show.
You know it.
For the cool kid, Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.